taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene. Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janoukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. Spoken Word broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the show, I have Caroline Williamson to talk about her new book of poetry, Carboniferous, published by Rabbit. She was born in London and has Welsh ancestry on one side of her family. She migrated to Australia in the 1990s. Carboniferous is her second collection. Welcome to the show, Caroline.
Hi.
Carboniferous does that rare thing in poetry, the political filtered through the lyric. It takes us from 19th century Wales to 21st century Australia. Could you read the opening poem, The Working Class?
Sure, and I should start by saying that it has little bits of Welsh, including in the title of each poem, but I am not a Welsh speaker. So my apologies to any Welsh people listening for my appalling pronunciation. A dosbarth gweddiol, the working class. On the dawn of March the 18th, Paris arose to the thunderburst of Vive la Commune, writes Karl Marx in London, 1871. In Wales, the price of coal has fallen and the owners want a reduction in wages. A man from Carmarthenshire calls on the miners of Cap Coeur, Glamorgan, to join the amalgamated association. The family talks it through over supper. The men and boys sign up in the morning. Pay cut goes through regardless. The union puts in its claim. Barricades rise in the streets of Paris. The masters won't recognise the union. It's not looking good. Esther lugs home enough flour to keep them going for a month. A delegate meeting in Mountain Ash decides the men will settle for 5%. The masters of the big pits refuse. The smaller proprietors agree. 11,000 men bring out their tools on June the 1st. The commune has fallen and bloody reprisals are underway. Its martyrs are enshrined in the great heart of the working class, writes Marx, blotting his messy manuscript.
Well, I think that poem beautifully introduces the themes that are going to run through Carboniferous. Tell us about the project.
Well, the project emerged. It didn't really begin with a single idea, and it became an obsession for quite a few years. The discovery that there was so much left in terms of trying to reconstruct the lives of coal mining communities in the 1870s. And while I couldn't get an overview, I couldn't re-inhabit that time, I could either imagine or reconstruct little bits of people's lives. So the thing was written like one little section at a time and not in any particular order. I was left with this mishmash of pieces all written in the same form. I'd found this form that worked, the length that worked for the kind of detail I wanted to include. But it was difficult to find the narrative. This was the creative section of a PhD, and it got through the PhD process, but it was in no way finished. So a few years ago, I got back down to it and managed to rearrange and write more in a way that brought out what I thought I was trying to say, which is a very messy way of saying that there really wasn't an initial question. It was a question of finding what I could and allowing the questions to emerge.
But in essence, in Carboniferous, you're exploring an aspect of Welsh society and history, which is 19th century coal mining. And you have Welsh ancestry on one side. So were you in part excavating your own history through this project?
Absolutely. Though I should point out, I started with a line from Walter Benjamin, who wrote, "In order for a part of the past to be touched by the present instant, there must be no continuity between them." So I've never visited the village I'm writing about. I didn't know my great-grandparents. I would go to see my grandparents in Merthyr Tydfil, regularly as a child, but that sort of came to an end after my mother died, very young. And I grew up with just a few words of Welsh. But I found that at that distance, it gave me a kind of freedom to use what I could, to explore, to see what there was and use it in any way I wanted to, in a way that I couldn't have done if I was writing, say, about my grandparents who I knew.
Well, you recreate 19th century Welsh society focused around the coal mining industry extremely beautifully, I might say. I have a real sense of the lives of these peoples. I especially enjoyed the way you bring in 19th century Welsh women. I would love you to read Household and tell us how you see Welsh women's lives in Carboniferous. What was it that you were trying to recover?
I was discovering rather than recovering, I think. I didn't have many preconceptions. As I read, I found that in some ways Welsh women were less constrained by ideas of femininity than English women might have been at that time. There's a marvellous autobiography of an Englishman who became a miner in South Wales, who was both charmed and terrified by the freedom of the Welsh women in his village. And you get that feeling in a lot of other contexts, which is not to say that their lives were easy in any way, as I think you can see from some of what happens in this narrative. I'll read you Toily. Toily, household. You open the door and whatever weather is passing along the valley blows right into your face. Snowflakes across the floorboards of the front room or a splash of rain and cold dust brought in on the wind. And the neighbours standing to gossip in any weather. At the back, bare earth and builder's rubble. A downpipe funnels the rainwater into a wooden barrel. A privy out the back is shared with the neighbours. Thomas will clear the soil, bury manure knee-deep to feed a garden. Cockroaches flourish in the kitchen. Esther sweeps, mops, scrubs and sweeps again for a moment of cleanliness. But it's a house. Thomas's travelling days are nearly over. Plenty of big new mines within a couple of miles. Nobody's joining the union anymore. Wages are down. The Amalgamated Association can't afford to go on strike. The coal owners have formed their own combine. And Esther needs him around the house. A blocked gutter. A patch of damp at the back. A baby on the way. So this is the early days in the marriage of my great-grandparents, as I imagine it. I think I became aware of how very hard it was just to do basic housework, basic cleanliness. And that's just the beginning, because women's lives were difficult in other ways. There was a sort of intersection of a very kind of free and easy, in some ways, peasant life a generation earlier, in which people basically got married once somebody got pregnant. And sometimes there would be two young women pregnant by the same man and he could only marry one of them. And then the growing power of the chapel and of Victorian morality in the late 19th century. So at this point, I imagine my great-grandmother Esther as probably waiting to marry or not getting pregnant or whatever. I can't know that. But it's very clear that that wasn't the case for everybody.
Because, of course, in Carboniferous, the characters, the personalities you're exploring are, in fact, family members, most of them, aren't they?
Yes. Not all of them, but yes. Or they're local people, as I discovered them in the local papers, which are online at the National Library of Wales. It's the most extraordinary resource for anyone who's looking at that period. You can find the local court cases and the news, the disputes, the deaths and births, and it's all there, raw.
Yeah, because many of the poems in Carboniferous, they're archival work. They've been recovered from the archive, whether it's family letters or newspapers.
Mm. That's right. To begin with, when I started the work, they were not yet fully digitised. They weren't available online, and I got photocopies from the library, which was an amazing service. But by the time I finished, if you go to look at the Aberdare Times now, it's all there right up to about 1920. And they reported in detail every little local problem.
Which is what I found quite amazing about the poems, is that they're intellectually powerful, but they also bring out the lives, the inner lives of these people. And I wondered how you managed to do that.
Imagination. I mean, there's a difficult, not really difficult. I wanted the work to be as fully researched as possible, but that doesn't give you people's inner lives. But knowing, for example, that my great-grandmother sang in this huge choir, as well as the chapel choir, I know what it's like to sing in a choir. And I can send her to choir practice. I know what the Welsh weather is like. I can't imagine what it was like practicing in an unheated chapel in winter. But I can describe that and assume that I'm fairly close.
What comes through strongly in Carboniferous is Welsh identity, yet the collection also confronts how moving away and intermarriage challenged that identity. You make that explicit in the poem Language, where the Welsh language disappears within a generation. Could you read the poem and tell us what interested you in that moment of language loss?
I think I'm carrying a certain amount of shame at not ever having really learnt the language. I remember my grandfather trying to teach me a few words, and he gave me a hanky, which had little pictures on of the Welsh word for each thing. And I must have been about 11 years old, and I'd just started learning French. And there was the Welsh word for window, which was fenêtre, which is so close to the fenêtre in French. And I looked at that and thought, what is going on here? And I'm still not entirely sure. I need to do more work on the origins of the Welsh language. So, iaith, language. My mother and her sisters went to school in a mansion built by an ironmaster. Merthyr Tydfil, the prettiest sister, constantly in trouble for failing to wear a hat in public. Disgraceful. And her father, such a great man too. By this time, not minor. Not even a trade union official, but a member of parliament. He got himself under attack for having a go at a public campaign for donations to the war effort. Goebbels would love you, bellowed a local paper. He thought that working people should not be asked to support the profiteers, getting rich on the backs of men who were out there fighting against Hitler's armies. Difficult to have a father who knew he was always right. My mother went to a teacher's training college, evacuated up north to Bangor, then home to teach at the school that nearly expelled her. Girls' gymnastics, hockey, a couple of English boyfriends. Married the quiet one and moved to London. That's how easy it is for a language to go missing. One generation, and all the children can say is Dioch and North Star.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I'm talking with Caroline Williamson about her new book of poetry, Carboniferous, published by Rabbit. Now, Caroline, you're also politically motivated. As an activist and a poet, you grapple in Carboniferous with a difficult tension, environmental responsibility, alongside a sympathetic response to the loss of mining communities in Wales. Could you read Spy and speak about this tension?
Yeah, I should explain that this poem, Aspure, Spy, was written after I went down to the Latrobe Valley to what used to be a little mining museum at Loy Yang B, the big brown coal power station, which is still open, I believe. I wanted to bring the poem up to date and into Australia. And I found myself in this little tour group going around inspecting the open cut mine before we went into the museum, which was an extraordinary experience, and I'm very glad I did it. But, well, the poem speaks for itself. Aspir, spy. What are you doing here if you're not part of the industry? She is not a local, she is a visitor. He's a retired miner. They've got a daughter working in Kalgoorlie. They're pleasant people, not entirely sure whether to be friendly or suspicious. Embattled coalfield. She knows that there are thousands of over-educated city people campaigning to close it down. I tell her about my mining ancestors and learning Welsh, but none of it sounds good. I only wanted to know about coal mines now. Later, talking with friends, I have everyone's full attention. You went on your own? Who did you contact? Can anybody just turn up? Were you vetted? What did you think they thought of you? Stuck out like a sore thumb, I tell them sadly. This is the opposite of finding my ancestors. This is an accidental but serious political initiative. Do you think you might go back? Asks a hard-working environmental campaigner. Can I come too?
So how do you hold a tension between empathy for the mining communities that have been lost and a desire to be politically active towards the environment?
I think this is where poetry comes in. I think Keats said something about holding two irreconcilable propositions in your head at the same time. These are not completely irreconcilable, but they are immediately in opposition to each other. I go on to describe, you know, you're looking at this massive, massive hole in the ground, and there's like one man in the distance in an air-conditioned cab pulling out the side of a cliff, basically, from a safe distance with one machine. And that would have been employment for a couple of thousand men in the 19th century. Coal mining is not a hand, is not done by hand in the Latrobe Valley. So it is no longer a mass employer. And in Britain, of course, the coal mines have entirely closed now. And it's a question of how those communities continue and survive, whether there's any alternative employment, what kind of investment there is. South Wales is one of the poorest areas of Britain now, and since Brexit it's become even poorer because the European community was investing in those areas and that was withdrawn. That funding wasn't replaced. So there's a lot going on under the surface, I think, for me, politically. I was really feeling my way. I didn't want to stand back and pass judgment as I might do, I might have done, as an out-there campaigner. I wanted to hold both those things in my mind at the same time.
Well, that's what I find very interesting about the poetry in Carboniferous, because it marries the lyric to the political, where through the lyric we feel an empathy towards the mining communities of the 19th century, even as we know what coal is doing to the environment in the 21st century, yet you still manage to bring across that destruction. That's not an easy position to hold in a poem. How did you manage to do that?
I think by following my nose, really. I don't think I had a project. It was more a refusal to allow myself to be forced into one rhetorical position or another. And I think rhetoric is, those fixed positions lead to so many poor political outcomes. You know, you have working class communities that feel they've been abandoned. And, you know, as a society, I think there's a huge failure to acknowledge the loss of those jobs, the necessary loss of those jobs and its impact on communities, and to think through alternatives. I mean, there's work being done, and I'm not really across it, but I know that, you know, the Victorian government has invested massively in those coal mining areas.
Carboniferous also explores tensions between Welsh workers in the 19th century, the Welsh miners, and the English bosses or masters, and the Jewish refugees who were fleeing pogroms in Eastern Europe and settling in Wales. How much anger toward the bosses was redirected by the miners onto those refugees? Could you read Gossip and speak about that part of the collection?
Absolutely. And I should say that when I discovered that my great-grandfather, if it was him, was getting involved in anti-Semitic trends within his own village, I almost gave this project up. A Jewish friend of mine in the UK said, don't be too hard on him. They were all like that. I thought, well, that's bracing. I'll see what I can do. So, clicks, Gossip. And this is my great-grandfather's words from when he began writing a little column in the local paper in Welsh. Seems that the pawn shop trades in valuable things, not just in jewellery, but in clicks a hell with, gossip and lies, keeping the uncircumcised nations in open warfare. Saturday evening in Cap Coch was wild, from 11 o'clock at night to 3 in the morning. Just as hot here, says the fox, as the battle in Alexinats between the Turks and the Serbs. That siege just weeks ago, and here are these cynical jokes already. Although he blames the pawnbroker's lies, he does his best to be even-handed. Can't let the Christians off scot-free. I did look bad on them Sunday, still drunk under their wounds. A black eye in chapel, bloodstains on a well-scrubbed doorstep. He thinks perhaps it's time a few individuals were jailed, so the rest of us can have some peace in this place. And what was the fox doing that night? Out there throwing punches on behalf of the forces of virtue? Grabbing a collar, dragging some hothead home to his angry mother? Esther is worried. Have you been stirring things up, Thomas? Was it something you wrote in the newspaper?
What do you attribute that violence towards the Jewish refugees?
I should say alcohol is definitely a factor. I was lucky enough to find that somebody wrote a book on the Jews of South Wales, and that sort of filled in the background, that these were often quite large extended families who had moved to a capital city, set up a business, and then they would send out a son or a cousin to a village as a sort of little offshoot. So this bloke in this tiny, remote Welsh mining village probably had relatives in Cardiff, and he was doing his best to manage on his own. And he wasn't doing badly because people came out in his support once the fox had a go at him in the local paper, and it created problems in the community. I don't think that there was a very well-developed sense of class consciousness at this point. You had the beginnings of a trade union. You might see in some of the other poems that the fox, which is my great-grandfather's pen name, he doesn't blame the bosses at all. He blames the middlemen, the kind of middle management, for not doing their job properly and for corruption and all sorts of other things. But he reckons if the bosses were doing their job properly, there wouldn't be a problem. So we're not talking Marxist thinking here at all. And the aim of the union was just to get better wages. The fact that the Jewish family didn't turn up to chapel, that would have triggered quite a lot of aggression in some people. They would have been probably the only family in the whole village that didn't go to chapel. And there was no synagogue, so they couldn't worship anywhere else. There was no public representation for that community at all. And this was only the beginning. It got much worse. You know, 30, 40 years later, there was actually a pogrom in another village just over the mountain, which resulted in troops having to be sent from London to suppress the violence. So I don't know if it was a diversion from the bosses. I think mix of religion, alcohol, poverty, ignorance, and a dislike of the outsider.
In the final section of Carboniferous, you emerge more directly in the poems, engaging with questions of place. Could you read Valley from the final section and speak about the different inheritance and identities within the work and how they shape your reading of past and present, and perhaps your own present moment?
Yeah, this one, Coombe Valley, is about the journey from Melbourne to Traralgon by train. Half close your eyes. Grey rocks, small scrubby trees, the steep walls of a narrow valley just the other side of the train windows. This could be one of those old Welsh railways clattering from one mining town to another and on to Cardiff, Swansea, the holiday beaches of Barry Island, donkeys and ice cream, a day return in August, the highlight of the summer. Half close your eyes and eucalyptus, acacia, blur into stunted hawthorn. The train keeps going. The walls of the little valley drop away, open to a wide plain, flat as a puddle, stretching to the horizon. A chessboard. End game. The kings, a rook, a knight or a bishop or two at an inconceivable scale. Generators, brown coal to electricity, towering above a patchwork of fields, majestic as medieval castles, warring nobles eyeing the opposition from their ramparts, counting their troops. And now an open pit gapes, deep and black, at a weirdly dazzling sky. I suppose this is partly a poem about displacement and the loss of a familiar landscape. As a child, we would drive from London to Wales along these narrow mountain roads. There was one called Black Rock Pitch, where my father, who was a very good driver, would slow right down, especially round corners, because you could go round a corner and there'd be a flock of sheep completely blocking the way. It was an adventure, you know, have we got to Black Rock Pitch yet? And now, of course, it's all freeway. But I still have that landscape in my mind, and it's still there, it's just not the main way of getting around. But Merthyr Tydfil had coal mines more or less within view. It was very local. You'd see, you know, the wheels at the top of the pit entrances. There was coal dust everywhere. Here in Melbourne, we have our electricity generated from this extraordinary plane way out of sight. It felt alien to me, quite suddenly, again. And I realised I was remembering those coal mining valleys and being faced with this massively different landscape.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
I'm Tina Janoukas, and you've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I've been speaking with Caroline Williamson about her new collection of poetry, Carboniferous, published by Rabbit. Carboniferous is available from Rabbit. Spoken Word broadcasts every Thursday at 9 a.m. or you can download the podcast. Thank you for listening.